certainly it's damaging the organization because it raises questions about whether we are doing good work with the public's money.
The Denali Commission takes the national spotlight in a letter to Congress. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the FAA closes some Alaska airport runways over a safety concern.
We simply can't shut off access into our rural villages over the application of a safety standard where it just doesn't make sense.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
The federal co-chair of Alaska's Denali Commission was taken by surprise early this morning when a Washington Post reporter called for reaction to a letter sent to Congress that advocated for dissolving the commission. It was surprising because the letter came from an employee, Mike Marsh, the commission's inspector general. I spoke with commission co-chair Joel Niemeyer in his office in downtown Anchorage this afternoon. He said Marsh's letter is damaging to the organization.
Because it raises questions about whether we are doing good work with the public's money. Whenever that's raised, that is a concern. For me, the point in his letter, which really I find problematic, is that he suggests that, and he calls them micro settlements, but our small rural Alaska villages essentially aren't worthy of federal investment through the Denali Commission. If you take that farther, you then say, well, if they're not worthy of federal investment by the Denali Commission, are they worthy of federal investment by the Indian Health Service, EPA, Department of Agriculture, Housing, Urban Development? Then you have to say, what about the rest of rural America? There's over 50 million Americans who live in rural America. If you follow the train of the logic, should we not invest in rural America? And I don't agree. I think we should invest in rural America. I think we should invest in rural Alaska. And I don't agree with his opinion.
He likened the Denali Commission to being a middleman and said that money should be sent, if they're going to spend this money in rural Alaska, it should be spent or sent directly to the tribes or to the state. How do you respond to that?
That is a question of what value does the commission add. And I believe the commission adds a tremendous amount of value. I'll give you two examples. The first is on our health facilities program. At the time we developed it, and I was the one who developed it 12 years ago, there was no one state or federal agency that had overarching responsibilities for primary care facilities in rural Alaska. Well, we raised our hand as an agency. We said, we'll take lead. So we developed a process that In effect, put in 120 state-of-the-art facilities. So what we did is we developed a process that worked with the community, worked with stakeholders to identify what are those health needs in the community, and then translate those health needs into facility space, and then we translated it into funding. I use that as an example to showcase how the commission can convene many program partners who touch an issue but don't embrace the entire issue because of their statute or regulatory limitations. And so currently we're working on one on energy efficiency. Many folks are working on energy efficiency. As you know, energy costs have increased threefold in rural Alaska in the last 10 years, and it's very debilitating to a lot of households. So you have a lot of agencies working on trying to address this. But what we have observed and we're trying to demonstrate is try to do a community-scale non-residential energy efficiency upgrade. So you use the economy scale of coming into the community and doing all energy audits at one time. And that's very hard to do. And that gets to what I think is the magic of the commission, where we add value, in that ability to convene all the different players and then take on an issue that no one player can do, but we can.
There's a lot of support from the congressional delegation. The Denali Commission has gone from a high in 2006, I believe, of about $160 million to $150 million to, I think, the average allocation now is about $10 million.
We receive about $10 million in discretionary funds, and then we also have another pot of funding called TAPL, Trans-Alaska Pipeline Liability. So all told, we're about $16 million a year. Although that is a far cry from $150 million, let me tell you, $16 million is a lot of money, and we could do a lot of good things if we leverage them right and address things. So if you talk about the question of energy efficiency and looking at modest little projects, that may not seem like much, but if we can work with program partners and develop it so that you do it on a community scale, that can be very impactful.
Denali Commission Co-Chair Joel Niemeyer speaking from the Commission's headquarters in Anchorage today. A copy of the letter is at our website, alaskapublic.org. Alaska occasionally gets caught in federal rules that may work in Ohio, but not in Ozinki. One such national policy that has been confounding airport managers and pilots may be close to at least a temporary fix for Alaska. The Federal Aviation Administration has begun enforcing a 37-year-old policy that defines the clearance area for airport approaches. Obstacles in that glide path entering or leaving an airport must be dealt with, or the FAA says those airports will be closed to night or instrument flying. Alaska Air Carriers Association Executive Director Joy Journey says that's a big problem for Alaska.
So you can come in when the weather's good, when it's clear. You cannot fly by instruments, which automatically for these closures means they're all down at night. That's a very grave concern when you're talking about medical evacuations, because effectively the closures at Haines, the closure for 2 weeks at Sitka, it basically meant if you needed to be airlifted out of there at night, an operator couldn't come in.
The obstacles may be trees, a new building, cell tower, or in the case of one of Homer's approaches, a dirt pile. Journey says association members have been frustrated by a lack of clarity as to which airports have problems and what the fix will be. FAA Alaska Region Head Bob Lewis says about five of the more than 100 that originally had obstacle concerns are still being worked on, but he didn't have a list. Steve Hatter is the Deputy Commissioner of Aviation for the State Department of Transportation. Hatter would only say the list is a moving target that changes daily.
We've got a bunch of rural airports up in our northern region, and so we're concentrating there right now.
Hatter says the state operates more than 250 airports and all have come up for review by the FAA. Hatter says they have whittled down the list of concern to a handful.
That said, they're still going to continue reviewing approaches out into the future, and that's where we're trying to get some help from them on when they schedule those reviews. So we'd like to push as many as we can out towards the spring time frame so that if we do discover that there's a obstruction problem, we've got reaction time and we can go address it in the spring and in the summer months.
Hatter says the one-size-fits-all national policy doesn't work well in a state where 82% of the airports are not accessible by road. He says DOT is aggressively working on the issue with FAA.
We simply can't shut off access into our rural villages over the application of a safety standard where it just doesn't make sense. And we need to make sure we can do medevac 24/7. We need to make sure people have the right ability to get in and out of those villages for whatever function they need.
The Air Carrier Association's Journey says Alaska's congressional delegation has gotten involved, and she's hopeful there will be more clarity in coming days. More areas of the Chukchi Sea may open up for oil and gas exploration in 2016, but the decision has not been made yet. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is calling for comments on a proposed lease sale in the area, but this time they are doing things differently. BOEM Regional Director James Kendall says the proposal calls for opening small, targeted areas for leasing, not the whole region. In order to do that, they are asking for very specific comments from the public and from industry. Kendall says they want to know exactly what areas are used for specific purposes or for animal migration and when.
We're looking for substantive pieces of information that, you know, will help us make this decision. You know, this is an opportunity for everyone to roll up their sleeves and go through this very meticulous process.
Kendall says they are keeping in mind Shell's current activities in the region and the challenges the company faced in the Arctic. In a statement, the Wilderness Society cited Shell's 2011 season mishaps as a reason not to propose a lease sale at this time. But the environmental group does support the use of a targeted sale as opposed to a region-wide opening. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Wrangell charity helps expecting mothers and new parents.
I mean, they're there for everyone. It doesn't matter, you know, just for any parents that could use this stuff. It was awesome.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Calling all Alaskan artists, Alaska Public Media's annual art showcase and auction is February 6th through the 8th. This unique opportunity features Alaskan artists and their work in fine arts media in a live auction, televised around the state and in an online catalog. Deadline for submission is December 16th. Visit alaskapublic.org for more information. Proceeds benefit Alaska Public Media.
The State Department of Law says it's just beginning to review post-conviction relief applications filed on behalf of the Fairbanks Four. The applications center on sworn statements from two individuals tying the 1997 murder of John Hartman to people other than the men jailed for the crime. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the state and local criminal justice officials are proceeding cautiously.
Alaska Department of Law Criminal Division Director John Skidmore says the ultimate responsibility of deciding whether the convictions of George Freese, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent stand will be with a judge assigned to the case.
But before we get there, obviously the state of Alaska is going to need an opportunity to review the application and the supporting documentation which has been filed and to determine what position we'll take.
Skidmore says the new evidence has to be clear and convincing that the Fairbanks Four are innocent. He says determining that will involve comparison of statements from the new suspects and admissions of guilt by Vent and Freese during police questioning immediately after the Hartman murder, confessions that were later recanted.
Now you have somebody else who is confessing, so there's going to have to be a simultaneous discrediting of one confession and substantiating the other.
Skidmore says additional information in the applications raises questions about other issues and evidence presented during the Fairbanks Four trials,
including shoe print analysis as well as eyewitness identification. So there are lots of issues that need to be looked at and thoroughly reviewed in this and then may be litigated. I don't know yet. It's just too early to determine that.
Skidmore says a lawyer will be assigned to review the applications and the state will decide on how to move ahead based on the attorney's recommendations. He adds that the state may have trouble getting through all the data in the allotted 45 days due to the amount of history in the case.
You have to keep in mind, there were three different trials that occurred in this case for these four individuals. There have been appeals. There have been previous post-conviction reliefs. So there's a lot of other information that needs to be reviewed and compared to what's been filed here to really sort out where we are and what the appropriate response is.
Skidmore says it's rare that someone comes forward and admits to a murder others have already been convicted of. An additional investigation may be required. That could happen with or without involvement of Fairbanks police. City Police Chief Laren Zager says he'll jump at any request from the court system, but the new evidence does not meet his standard for police to initiate action.
I'm not quite there with this. I will admit I'm much closer with this than I have been with some of the other arguments that have been put on the table. But there's other balancing information that's involved, not all of which I'm privy to and not all of which I'm at liberty to disclose. But there's always another side, so to speak, to the story. And this is a bit marginal.
Zager says the new information is suspect because it comes from someone in prison with nothing to lose, and it's unclear what the motivation is. The Tananaw Chiefs Conference is offering a $35,000 reward for information leading to the exoneration of the Fairbanks Four. TCC Justice Task Force Chair Shirley Lee says money will only be paid out if the Fairbanks Four are set free. She says the committee has not discussed the potential of money going to former Fairbanks resident William Holmes, who's serving a double life sentence for other murders. A letter from Holmes saying he and a group of high school friends carried out the 1997 attack on John Hartman is the centerpiece of the Fairbanks Four's application for post-conviction relief. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Congress has passed a one-year extension of a program that pays out millions of dollars to communities in Alaska near national forest land like Petersburg. The extension of the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act of 2000 was approved by the House and Senate this week. Alaska Republican Lisa Murkowski and Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden, the ranking Republican and Democratic chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, co-authored the measure. Murkowski says the federal funding program is an annual concern she hears from residents of Southeast.
So making sure that we have an opportunity to at least give certainty to our communities in the Tongass for secure rural schools funding for FY14, this was critical. This is vital, and I can share the good news that we've got funding for this next year. $16 million will be coming to the state again.
The extension continues payments for 1 year at the same level as last year. Petersburg has been getting more than $1 million annually under the program. Most of the money helps pay for school operations. The Secure Schools extension was part of a broader piece of legislation that sells off reserves of helium held by the federal government. The bill goes next to the president for his signature. The White House this month issued a statement of support for Wyden and Murkowski's legislation on the helium reserve. The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska is raising concerns about health information exchanges online in Alaska. The regional databases allow doctors to access medical records, but ACLU of Alaska Interim Executive Director Joshua Decker says people have no choice about whether their information is included.
State assumes right now that if you are silent, you want your medical records to be shared online.
Decker says it would be better if Alaskans had to actively choose to be included. He says the ACLU is also concerned about rules governing operation of the health information exchanges, which are currently set by private companies that manage them.
It is not formal statutes or regulations, and because of that, it means that these rules can be changed overnight with little to no notice to patients.
Decker says it would be better to have state-set regulations, so there's public comment. Security is another concern identified by Decker. He says expert review showed privately run Alaska health information exchanges are vulnerable to hackers and access by federal agencies.
Right now, we do not know if, for example, the NSA could snoop into this database to find that information. But what we do know is that the NSA has been getting private information from a lot of Americans, and it's also been sharing this information with other organizations, including the Drug Enforcement Agency and the Internal Revenue Service.
Decker says the ACLU hopes to resolve the health information exchange issues without legal action. Decker will be sharing the ACLU's concerns tomorrow during the group's annual Liberty Brunch in Fairbanks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Lauren Rosenthal. This week on AK, Baby Boost. As in many small towns in Alaska, no babies are delivered in Wrangell's hospital. Expectant mothers have to leave town to give birth. When they return, there aren't many services to help them adjust to life with a little one, except for Hannah's Place, a nonprofit that provides free courses for expecting couples and new parents. In exchange for taking the classes, parents have access to a free store that has nearly everything an infant needs. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver has the story.
I walk across a neat lawn bordered with flowers to get to the small yellow and white house that's called Hannah's Place. Nedra Schultz is the director of Hannah's Place. When I arrive, she invites me into a cozy living room.
One of the first things I do, I sort of go through, open everything up. I like to turn the lights on. I usually light a candle, get the doors open and things, just so it will seem homey, you know, and welcoming. Turn on a little bit of background music.
It doesn't feel like a business. It feels like a home. Hannah's Place is a nonprofit that started about 2 years ago to help new moms adjust to life with a baby. While anyone is welcome, dads too, many of the women who come here are struggling a bit, either financially or as a single parent. It's volunteers like Schultz that keep the place running, and it's stocked with donated maternity and baby supplies. Schultz says a new mom could, in theory, get everything she needs from a first pregnancy test through the birth of a child and all the way until that kid is a toddler without spending a dime. In the living room, there's a baby sitting on the rug, playing with one of the many toys that's hidden around the room.
This is one of our clients' little ones, and most of them do bring their little ones with them, which is fun because then we get to see them and watch them grow. He's actually a little serious right now, isn't he? What you thinking, buddy?
His mom is one of the many young women that frequent Hannah's Place.
I'm Nika Mork, and this is Jonah Hurst, and he is almost 8 months old now. Aww. And we've been coming here for 3 or 4 months now. Twice a week we come here and get to visit. Yes. Oh, is you going to say something, Bubba? You too?
Mork says she's taken several of the video-based classes that Hannah's Place offers. They range from workshops on quick and healthy meal preparation to finding a cheap, used car and affordable insurance. She says one of the videos told her that Jonah would start sleeping through the night, eventually, but they're still working on that. When parents take the classes, they earn mommy bucks, and that brings us upstairs to the mommy store. The second floor bedrooms are set up like a children's boutique. Parents can redeem their bucks for anything inside. Schultz says this system of earning bucks for learning life skills gives these moms a sense of pride. And that's why she says it's important that all of the donated items look new and are not outdated.
We have nothing that has a spot on it. Nothing at all. We put those completely away. If someone were to come and ask me and say, you know, I want to look at those, I would let them just have them. But I don't put anything out at all that has a spot.
Along with access to the store, every mom in town with a newborn gets what Schultz calls a Celebrate Life basket. She delivers them to new parents as soon as possible after the birth. Marlo Ellsworth is a 27-year-old mother of three. Days before the birth of her second boy, her daughter was badly injured. Her husband flew to Seattle with their daughter for emergency care, which ultimately took over a month and cost him his job. After giving birth, Ellsworth and the two boys returned to Wrangell. She couldn't afford baby supplies and didn't know what to do.
We had zero money at that point. When we got back, you know, I stressed because my husband was out of work, I was out of work, and we'd spent so much money. Because even with help, you know, it's rough. And it was, I think it was like 1 or 2 days after I got home, there was a knock on my door, and I was like, oh, I'm not ready for visitors yet, you know.
And she found a Hannah's Place volunteer with one of those baskets outside. It was stuffed with diapers, burp rags, and bottles.
I didn't feel like I was... like, oh, she's really poor. Let's go give her a basket of stuff. No, it was very friendly. And I mean, they're there for everyone. It doesn't matter, you know, just for any parents that could use the stuff. It was awesome.
And director Nedra Schultz says that's what it's all about, helping people when they need it the most. For AK in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to the interior community of Venetai on the Chandelar River.
My name is Eddie Frank, and I'm the tribal administrator for the Venetai Village Council. Venetai is a small community. about 40 miles east of Fort Yukon on the Shenandoah River, and I think the population is between 180 to 200 people, primarily Nitsai Gujins. It's a different subgroup of the Gujin people. It's a good community. We're a dry community. It's self-imposed, and it's, I think it was the late 70s that the community decided that they were going to not allow alcohol in the community. We got snow. People are probably going to be busy doing wood cutting, and we're actually in the process of building a new health clinic. Well, we have projects. We have our own housing organization, and I understand they're building one house now. They finished two, and we just got done building the road. And it took us 4 years with Indian Reservation Road funds, but we just had a final inspection this week, and we're going to close that project down. Well, we have community events. I think what's coming up is a big Halloween party. They do it every fall. In Halloween, and they have costume contests. And they have a dance, and they give out prizes. Christmas and New Year's, it's a big celebration here. We have and we have fiddle dances. Yeah, it is fun when the community gets involved. I can remember when I was a kid, they'd dance all night until 4 or 5 in the morning, then they'd have potlatch again the next day, and then they'd dance all night again.
Eddie Frank is the tribal administrator in Venati. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Shady Grove Oliver, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Lauren Rosenthal. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks and Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg. APRN's Ann Hillman reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.